salty ocean, off where the waves roll free. The sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the blue frontier.
Welcome to Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast. This is David Helvarg, and my co-host is Vicki Nichols-Goldstein. And today, we're talking with Anna Blanco of the International Ocean Film Festival and filmmaker Sarah Nuremberg. But first, blue news you can use. Talk about a hot tub time machine. Scientists reporting 2023 was the hottest year for ocean temperatures ever, with 90% of the ocean experiencing at least one marine heat wave last year. I'd say if you're digging yourself into a hole, stop digging. And if you're scalding yourself, turn off the gas, also the oil and coal. It's time to shut down the fossil fuel cartel and triple down on clean energy. We can do better. Any good news, Vicki?
Yes, I'm excited to share some very uplifting news. Recent research reported in the journal Current Biology shows that coral reef restoration not only boosts coral cover, but also quickly restores key ecosystem functions. Transplanted corals can grow as fast as healthy ones within just 4 short years. This indicates that with reduced greenhouse gas emissions and climate stabilization, David, active management can significantly aid in coral reef recovery.
Well, that's a reef leaf or something like that. Anna's been with us before. Since 2011, she's been executive director of the International Ocean Film Festival and has guided its growth as a global force in blue media. Full disclosure, Anna's also co-directing a documentary on kelp forests, Sequoias of the Sea, with Blue Frontier's associate director, Natasha Benjamin. A work in progress we're proud to count as one of our projects. Yay. Sarah Nuremberg is director and producer with Terra Matter Studios, a subsidiary of Red Bull based in Vienna, Austria, that has produced some amazing nature and science documentaries, including one of my favorites, Sea of Shadows. Her directorial debut film is Orca, Black and White Gold, another true life thriller tracking the billion-dollar black market trade in orcas between Russia and China that resulted in the release of over 100 killer whales kidnapped from their wild ocean families. So, Anna, let's start with you. And when and where is your 21st annual film festival taking place?
Well, thank you, David, for having me. The 21st anniversary film festival will be taking place at Cowell Theater, which is on the campus of Fort Mason Center for Arts and Culture, which is along the northern waterfront of San Francisco. And it takes place on the weekend of April 12th to the 14th. So it's 3 days.
How many films do you have this year?
We have 35 films this year.
So one of the films in the festival is going to be Sarah's film.
Black and White Gold.
Black and White Gold. Well, what is that? Tell us the story.
Yeah, happy to be here. So the film is about what happened after Blackfish. So we're 10 years after Blackfish, and the situation pivoted from the West to the East. So SeaWorld was after it had faced backlash after the documentary Blackfish was released in 2013.
Blackfish, for those who don't remember, we actually gave it a Peter Benchley Ocean Award. It was a documentary about abuse of orcas in captivity, with a specific focus on SeaWorld.
Yeah, and the documentary was shifting public attitudes about holding orcas in captivity that really changed dramatically thanks to the documentary. And SeaWorld was looking for new frontiers of business and was pinpointing out China. And in China, they have been building, inspired by SeaWorld as a blueprint, so to say, a bunch of aquariums. And they all wanted to have orca whales as their marquee performers. But what they did not count on was that SeaWorld, they don't sell their animals, they rent them for a profit share of every single ticket sold. And that didn't seem like a good business model for the Chinese. So they were looking for a one-stop shop solution and turned towards the Russians. And the story is set out in the far Russian East, where a ragtag team of orca catchers caught for the Chinese aquariums 10 orca whales and 87 beluga whales. They're big money. So an orca goes on the market for $10 million each and a beluga whale for $500,000 or so. and they were all bound to be exported. If not for a group of very courageous activists who sounded the alarms and then swayed the government to release them back into the wild.
So these were Russian grassroots activists who were just fighting the cetacean slave trade?
So the organization was called Ocean Friends and the Boomerang Club, situated at the Sakhalin Island, which is super remote in Russia. And they were unfortunately disbanded after Russia was clamping down on environmental organizations and they were facing retribution. But it was a small team of just 7 people who were already in the business of educating children about like entangling fur seals from nets and fishing lines, but also were on the forefront when Russia started the orca catches years ago. And they have introduced legislation, successfully so, and created a campaign with lots of signatures of Russian citizens who ultimately created that pressure on the government to reverse course.
This was after the whales had been captured. They were still able to pass legislation to protect their export.
Yes, exactly. So they were actively fighting the captures as they got the permits to go out there and catch these whales. But before, of course, when they knew that the Russians were interested in doing that, and then while these animals were at the so-called whale jail, which are holding pens off the coast of Vladivostok, where they kept the animals until they were exported or bound to be exported. And then afterwards, they actually managed to introduce the species into the Russian Red Book, so as labeled as an endangered species as a whole, so they couldn't be caught any longer. And just last year, the Duma, which is the government in Russia, they passed a ban on the capture of cetaceans for public display altogether. So that was just the benefit of this small group of activists, what they accomplished, yeah.
Well, let's go back to the movie. So I want to kind of make sure I understand this. So Russia is capturing these orcas and also other toothed whales, and then they are selling them to China for sea parks. How many sea parks are there in China, and are they building new ones? Is this like an active market?
Yes. So unfortunately, it is an active market. And in China, they built the sea parks. They went along with property development. And so they were looking, if they build a new property, that the families who were supposed to move in there had some sort of entertainment. And instead of just going for amusement parks, they wanted to have something which was, SeaWorld inspired, and build the aquariums. I don't have the number by heart currently, but there are a bunch of aquariums already, and they're still expanding on them. However, recently, because China has weaned itself off from the Russian cetaceans, because Russia is not catching cetaceans any longer, and there are no other supply chains at the moment for orca whales as a whole, they're not seeking any other animals there. And also, on a positive note, I have to say, it also has an impact on Taiji, actually. So if you remember The Cove, documentary.
Louis Sahoy's film that we interviewed him a number of months ago, years ago now, David.
Yeah, yes. Another Benchley Award winner.
Yeah, exactly. So on the dolphin slaughter at the Cove of Taiji, and they stopped exporting dolphins for China as well. So the trade has been cut off during COVID, COVID restrictions. On the same side, it's not very profitable because the hunts for the dolphins, they were catching them for dolphin meat, but they were just only getting a few $100 for it. And then they actually funded this business by selling live dolphins for aquariums, especially in China. And they got, $5,000 per dolphin. And since this trade died off, there is the outlook positively that it might come to a halt altogether because of that.
So there may now be no capturing of dolphins and whales for captive profit making.
Yes, and the dolphin slaughters hopefully are also going to stop at the same time. Yeah.
So these whale jails that you refer to, are there orcas or other toothed whales, dolphins, belugas, are they still in the whale jails?
So in the whale jails, they had pens that were outdoors where the beluga whales were housed. And then under a roof, they had the orca whales. And these were very confined and cramped enclosures. But they were discovered in 2018. And then in 2019, the release process started of the animals. So all the animals, the beluga and the orca whales, they have been released back into the wild. Oh. The orcas, to where they got caught in the first place, the belugas, only some of them, unfortunately, and the majority of which just outside the coast of Vladivostok, where now they became local. And so they founded their own little pods and stayed in the area. But moreover, there were also pinnipeds. They were catching walruses, and the walruses, I'm not too sure what happened to them. I don't think that they got released, but they got sold on.
So, and this is all, this whole amazing story is told in your documentary. How long is the documentary, and when's it out, or how long has it been out?
The documentary is 94 minutes, and it was very hard to get the whole story in there and to tell it. And just to add on to the whale jail, so the whale jail was dismantled altogether. So it is no longer, as there are also no longer catches in Russia happening. The documentary is now doing its festival circuit. So currently it is at the Blue Water Film Festival in San Diego, and then it's going to be at the International Ocean Film Festival with Anna. But I'm going to keep you guys posted where it's going to end up and find its home.
That would be great. Well, I've seen bits and pieces of it, and I'm fascinated with how you were able to get the footage. And also, I think I saw Putin in one of the clips. So tell us a little bit about how you were able to get some of this amazing footage that I think will surprise people when they watch your documentary.
It wasn't easy to get access, and access access is the key of this documentary. And I didn't want to make, and I'm making air quotes here, an activist documentary per se. So just getting to know the topic from one side of the activists. But my goal was to tell a 360 view of the story. Because for us, from a Western perspective, it's always easy to point the finger and say, oh, look at what the Chinese are doing here, and the mean, you know, Russians are catching the orcas, how dare they? But we have to reflect on where this is coming from, and we also have a cultural responsibility. And this is what I wanted to incorporate, that the blueprint of this was created in the US by SeaWorld. And so the catchers who were in the business of the whale jail and the export, they were also just wondering, okay, so why are the Americans allowed to do that? Why are the Japanese allowed to catch whales? Why are, you know, the Norwegians allowed to? Why are not we? We're not killing them. We're catching them and trading them. And so I thought this was such a fascinating idea and, you know, a take on capitalism and what it actually means once we put a price tag on nature. So I wanted to have their viewpoint, so what actually made them go into the business, as well incorporated into the film. And that took quite a while to get close, because naturally they knew they have lost the media war.
I mean, there's some skill involved in capturing live whales. What was they're sort of cowboys in every culture. I mean, were these sort of far eastern Russian cowboys? What kind of cultural identity did these captors have?
So the cultural identity of the business owners behind it, because it took a lot of money to actually build the business around it. It's not just like you go out, you catch a whale, you bring it back home. No, it was an intense operation, and they already had a down payment from the Chinese aquariums, which raised the stakes even higher, because they've spent it on the catches, they spent it on building the whale jail. And after they were tasked to release them, people didn't know, will they still secretively, smuggle it to the Chinese to make good on the down payment or not? So there was a whole conspiracy going on around there. Okay, so the businessmen behind there, they had several businesses. They were gold mining, they in logging, fur trading, so all kinds of ventures. And for them, it was just yet another, because they feel entitled to what the nature, what their land holds to exploit for their own financial gain. And the people doing the hard work. So we featured an orca catcher who was the brains behind the operation itself. And he said that he learned it by going to Taiji, by watching other catchers, how they treat. So they were banging rods on the side of boats to disorient the animals. And there was trial and error, and also featured in the film, we do have footage of a scene where they're actively catching an orca calf. And that is just heartbreaking, because you see how it is netted off and how the parents are still around, and one orca gets entangled in the net as they try to keep it away. And so one can imagine that there have been several casualties, and the orca hunter, he was seeing that as man versus nature and conquering. So for him, that was just a challenge that he wanted to overcome.
And these orcas, they have such strong family bonds. It must be just heart-wrenching to see that, but also to have that, as David mentioned, that sort of cowboy mentality, like, I'm going to get this, and, the heck with the family bonds, this is my job. Wow, I'm really looking forward to seeing this.
It initially started with Keiko, who was a star in Free Willy, so that was 30 years ago, and children were petitioning Warner Brothers, the film studio, to release him after they learned that this was just a film stunt, that he jumped over into freedom. And they were saying, you lied to us, we really want for this whale to be freed. And then with the help of the Earth Island Institute, David Phillips is featured in the documentary as well. Keiko was flown to Iceland and was released there in the first seaside sanctuary. And then he got to go on walks, and he also met with free-ranging orcas on the way. But speaking of seaside sanctuaries, this is the humane way to think forward, because retiring the whales, even though SeaWorld was pledging, and also in California is mandatory, not to breed any longer. So the breeding has stopped. But the question is, of course, what happens to whales until they retire? And a seaside sanctuary would mean there's a protected area, coast, that is netted off, and the whales could go there and really experience the tides and have so much more space to roam and to dive, and so are stimulated. And there is a sanctuary being built that could be operational next year in Nova Scotia, that's close to Halifax. And this is where these animals could go. So far, SeaWorld is not very fond of the idea, or not actively supporting it. But once the sanctuary is operational, I'm sure that the public would create that pressure onto SeaWorld to do the humane thing and let their whales retire. They made a bunch of money off of them, and now they're anyways moving more towards the amusement park side of their business and barely are mentioning whales and dolphins anymore in their advertisements. So I think it's a matter of time until they get to retire.
Right. And our friend and past podcast guest, John Racanelli, director of the National Aquarium in Baltimore, he is began to set up a dolphin sanctuary in Puerto Rico, where he and a number of other aquariums realized that it's past time to hold captive cetaceans. They're going to move dolphins there. It's great to hear that there may be a whale sanctuary in Canada. I think we're reaching the point where wild pods of dolphins and whales are endangered. Oil spills in the Gulf of Mexico are still impacting dolphins over a decade later. Climate change is impacting the health of orca pods around the world. So it's good that people and films like yours are helping people to understand that it just doesn't make sense to be holding these intelligent, family-oriented species in captivity.
Okay, a quick break here. I'm sure you recognize my voice. I'm your co-host, David Helvarg. I'm also executive director of Blue Frontier that sponsors Rising Tide. If you enjoy our talks with the watermen and women making a difference for our ocean world, you might also want to check out our other work at www.bluefront.org. There you'll find links to many other projects, including our Blue Movement directory of over 1,200 ocean activist organizations, many near you. Again, check us out at bluefront.org. And if you enjoy Rising Tide, the Ocean podcast, spread the word to friends and families from sea to shining sea. And now, back to the show.
Anna, what's your sense? You've been at it since 2011. Is ocean cinema an expanding field?
Oh, I think most definitely, David. I mean, it's so interesting to hear people reference films that have left such a tremendous impact on them. And I think that's what the festival strives to do, is to raise awareness and then have people learn from the films and also just take them with them. For example, when you mentioned The Cove premiered at the film festival, and the next month was when it went off to win the Academy Award. And so there's a number of films. In fact, we showed a film on the Whale Sanctuary Project that Sarah referred to that's opening soon in Nova Scotia. And we just get so many films about so many different subject matters that is about the ocean. So I think that's been the biggest surprise for me over the years, is all the subject matter that we cover in film and in media, and just how many stories need to be told, whether it's people, like you said, who live along the coast, whether it's coral reefs, deep sea mining. It's just endless, the topics that filmmakers can cover. So for us, we're grateful to offer the platform in the form of a festival, and we're just grateful to filmmakers like Sarah who take it upon themselves to make these films and to tell these stories.
Do you or Sarah have a few favorite ocean films that come to mind?
One of my favorites, well, I have too many, David. That's like saying, who's my favorite child? You know, it's, straws. When we showed straws in the story of the straw that got stuck in the nostril of the turtle.
Yeah.
Costa Rica, that was one. Sand Wars is another one that I have people coming up to me at the festival and they say, oh my gosh, I never knew that sand, that was happening. There's a global market for selling sand, and I'll never forget that film. We get so many comments like that. Those are two that really stuck with me over the years. How about you, Sarah?
I would go for the popular ones. So most known, of course, The Cove. I have to mention that. And the writer Mark Monroe was also the writer on Orca Black and White Gold. So yeah. and Blackfish, naturally. It started off this whole movement. It really affected me, and it had such an impression on the public to raise a topic and to bring it to an awareness that hasn't existed beforehand. So I would just mention these two.
And
but there are many more.
Yeah, and there's so many growing list of good fiction movies, like, you know, Whale Rider or Secrets of Ronin-ish, or Surf's Up, which you may not be familiar with, but best animated penguin surfing movie ever.
Well, there are so many, and I applaud you, Anna, for having this film festival, which is really ocean related. And I wish there were other avenues to get these great films out. So, you know, hopefully as people's interest increases, and I think we are seeing an increase, it'll start having different tentacles, so to speak, to get out to the public. But Sarah, I do want to ask you, how did you come up with the name for your documentary, Orca, Black and White Gold?
So it was hard to find a name. The name was inspired by the article that the journalist Aliona was breaking about the whale jail. And it references the value of the animals, not the intrinsic value that it has as a sentient being, but the money and the price tag that was put on it. And I liked it a lot. The article that Aliona was writing, I think, was summarizing the business as a whole very well, encapsulating it in this claim, Orca Black and White Gold.
I really look forward to seeing your film. And when you tell me it was seven activists in the Russian Far East, it kind of reminds me of Margaret Mead's saying, always quoted or paraphrased, that don't doubt that a handful of people can change the world. Indeed, nothing else has. That these seven people stopped 100 whales from being exported and may, in fact, mark the end of the whole global trade in whales for entertainment and profit.
It is. It was so inspiring to see them do this and to see them pull this off. I also have to mention Xiaoran, the activist and protagonist that is featured in China. So she used to be a former trainer, and under her care, a dolphin committed suicide. Mm. So they can just stop breathing altogether. And this is what it did. So it couldn't bear the situation any longer.
Tragic.
And yeah, and decided to end it. And for her, that was a turning point, as she, like many other trainers, have a very deep relationship to the animals, although they're doing, you know, this exploitative work. Nonetheless, that led her to quit her job and dedicate her life to educating children.
With that, I would like to thank both of you, Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the International Ocean Film Festival, and Sarah Nordenberg, Director of Orca, Black and White Gold. Thank you so much for being on the Rising Tide Ocean podcast, and good luck with your careers and ocean protection and orcas and films, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky. Thank you, David.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Rising Tide, the Ocean Podcast, is a production of Blue Frontier, co-hosted by Blue Frontier's David Helbard and Vicki Nichols Goldstein of the Inland Ocean Coalition, with production support from Holden Hardcastle of Fluid Studios, Natasha Benjamin, and Nick Paz, and editing services provided by Charles Landon of Studio Cape May. You can find Rising Tide at bluefront.org or on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcast. And don't forget to recommend the Rising Tide Ocean Podcast to your friends and other ocean lovers.
Off in the salty ocean, off where the waves roll free, the sparkling water rises, then crashes to the sea. Out amongst the breakers, you'll have no need to fear. It's true, it's the Blue Frontier. Salty ocean, not to the Blue Frontier.
Sparky, come here, buddy. Sparky, there you are. Good boy, Sparky.